Yeah, Howie can chime in too, and no problem.
Go ahead with your question or comment, Howie.
Remember when Radio Shack used to sell lifetime guarantee tubes? I'll never buy them. I bought one. I think I bought a 12AX7 for my driver and my 6-meter radio, and I found out that the power went down by half. And I found out what they do. They run the filaments on slightly a higher voltage. There were higher voltage filaments, and they put out less output. Remember those tubes that were considered just lifetime guarantees by Radio Shack Candy? Go ahead, Dick.
No, I don't. That's a new one on me. However, where Rich, the N2EO, was telling us about his tubes that were the improper tube as far as the remote cutoff is concerned on the 6AZ8, and they ran physically very hot in the rig, and then he watched them drift. I'm going to make a guess here as to what could be going on. When a tube is manufactured, you want there to be an extremely high-quality vacuum inside. You don't want any air molecules inside that envelope, because the poor electrons that are trying to leave that cathode and go straight to the plate, if they bombard an air molecule, you get inefficiency and glow and some bad things happening, drift and whatever. The vacuum pump you put on a tube can only suck out a certain number of those air molecules. There's always a certain number of air molecules that go bouncing around inside, never find the hole, and never go down the tube into the vacuum pump. Some of them just bounce around in there forever. They're just unlucky ones, or the persnickety ones. So they put gettering material in there. In other words, near the end of the manufacturing process of the tube, they flash this gettering material, which acts like flypaper. It's that silvery-looking stuff you see on the inside of the glass envelope on many of these tubes. It acts like flypaper to the air molecules. They stick to the gettering material. They're no longer part of the vacuum, and the tube runs much higher efficiency. That's the good news. If now you've done something wrong, so the tube is running super hot, dissipating a hell of a lot more power, I think it's possible that the extra heat will boil off those air molecules from the flypaper, from the gettering material. That's one guess. Another guess is the tube running super hot means that you're overusing the cathode. The cathode's running at too high a temperature because of the extra heat going on inside the tube. So either of those phenomena. The way a tube is manufactured is you've got all kinds of exotic chemistry, heavy metals, that are embedded inside the cathode material. They are supposed to boil off at a particular controlled rate in order to keep the tube giving you the right emission years downrange. You do something to overheat the tube, like running the filament too high or running the plate dissipation too high, and you speed up that process. And pretty soon you boil up the materials too soon, too fast, and either is it failure of the gettering material, failure of the cathode material? I'm not sure which.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
But one or the other, in my guess, could be affecting tube performance downrange. Another thing I worry about is that tubes do have an aging characteristic. You're buying new old stock here, Rich. The possibility exists that some of this new old stock was manufactured a zillion years ago. And some tubes work great for a few years, but even if they're just sitting on the shelf for 20 years, they might not be so hot. Pun intended. So there's some guesses going on here. Anybody have any questions or comments on all of the above? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW and the Tech Man.
KKY, one more thing.
Mel recognized. Anyone else? You got it, Mel.
Hey, another thing what they went ahead the gentleman just mentioned Muller's tubes. Yeah, Muller's was an English company, and they came up with this idea. They were one of the proponents of when tubes started to be, the filament became what they call thoriated, called the thoriated filament. And supposedly, there was a big step forward, you know, towards as tubes now have matured, you know, to the point of something. I always think that if a transistor didn't come along, what we'd have in the way of vacuum tubes. I saw some one time I was saw some futuristic tube designs that they had envisioned, you know, 20 years and some real weird looking models. But what happened was that besides this process of thoriating the filament, what was going on with a lot of them? Now, you take, for instance, the 6AZ8 tube, because I had a lot of experience with KWF2 and all that stuff. That tube was designed basically as a what was known as an A1 type amplifier, class A1. And if you look at it, the way they had it in the circuit there, the way Collins was using it, they weren't using it classically in an A-class A1 type of amplifier. I mean, so, you know, they were taking a tube that just sort of fit their needs and didn't worry about, you know, its longevity, Dick, and that's why a lot of these fixes have come up to reduce the temperature of the cathode, over.
Yeah, I don't know about cathodes of vacuum tubes, but when it comes to incandescent light bulbs, you can get a huge increase in life of a light bulb if you run it at very slightly lower voltage. These extremely long life light bulbs are really bulbs that you could say are wired for 135 volts, but you're running at 120 volts. You get a little bit less light out of it, a little bit redder light, not quite as white, but you get a fantastic increase in life. I vaguely remember the life of a filament of an incandescent light bulb is a function of 1 over the voltage to something like the 12th power, some great big exponential number. So a very small change in voltage can make you a huge increase in life of an incandescent filament. And so when it comes to the filaments of vacuum tubes, traveling wave tubes, cathode ray tubes, and whatever, if you can get enough emission at a lower voltage, you're way ahead of the game to do it. I do remember the booster transformers they used to sell for picture tubes, cathode ray tubes, in the television days, where at the end of life, the tube was getting kind of low in emission, you were getting kind of a dim picture, and you buy one of these booster transformers, you hooked up to the neck of the picture tube, and it would boost the filament voltage from 6.3, I don't know what, but I'm going to guess it boosted up to 6.6, 6.8, some other number higher like that. In fact, some of those things, let me drop.
7.1 volts.
What was that again, Mario and Mel?
Could it, believe it or not, the 7.1. I measured it to see how high they went. They go up, they had a little pin in the back of this little booster, a high and a low pin. In the high position, it went to 7.1, over.
Out of curiosity, do you know what the low voltage number was, Mel?
That's about 6.8.
Okay, so at the end of life of your picture tube, you put this booster transformer that gave you either 6.8 or 7.1 volts. And to some degree, the picture tube came back into good operation. That's the good news. The bad news is the fix didn't work very long. You'd get a couple of more months out of the tube, and after that, boy, it was really sick. I bet you've seen that effect, Mel. Is that true? Go ahead.
Well, you know, rather than do that, to have little tricks and all this, the booster, the picture tube, you know, they came up with these CRT checkers, and, you know, they used to also have to clean the tube internally, to degas it, wherever they came up with that gassing thing. But it was a number of, you know, things that you did. Listen, whatever you could do to make a buck, you know. Listen, I know that I could say putting the booster on was a temporary bandage over the wound. But also, I could say I used to use that picture tube rejuvenator. You know, it was the typical things that were done in those back in those days, Dick, over.
Now, one of the modes of failure you had with a picture tube, occasionally the gun assembly, cathode material or something would flake off, lodge itself between a control grid and the cathode, or between some of the elements of the tube. So I wonder if one of these rejuvenators would just put a high enough voltage in there to burn off the flake that was giving you intermittent contact. There were tubes that always became microphonic because particles were running around inside. And if you could either shake them into the right position or burn them away, you would get some more life out of the tube. Was there a kind of rejuvenator that would burn away flakes of material that in between the anodes and grids and whatever of the gun assembly? Back to you, Mel.
You're talking about a cathode to grid short. No, what you did when you put that friction tube booster, friction tube tester and rejuvenator on, the first thing it did is jacked up the filament bulb to the tube. Sometimes you saw it lit up like it was going to pop the filament any minute. Got the cathode very, very hot, and then you discharge. You push the button, and it just discharged a filter capacitor that was like 350 mics at 450 volts right between the cathode and the grid, and you blasted it, actually, Dick, over.
What was the purpose of that blasting? What was it supposed to do? What error was that correcting, Mel? Go ahead.
You built up between the cathode and the control grid, you built up this whiskers that were being thrown off the cathode. That's actually the way they had once showed a picture of it under, that was shown under a microscope of a dissected gun. And the whiskers in there, these little fine whiskers, actually you blasted them away to remove the short stick, over.
Interesting. So even in those days they had whiskers. Nowadays you can easily grow whiskers inside of certain kinds of integrated circuits. And there are certain kinds of fluxes that are used on low temperature solders, which are very active. They will work their way through the leaves of particularly a plastic package integrated circuit, slowly crawl inside and eventually eat away at the active integrated circuit inside, the real chip. So there are procedures you have to go through to wash away these fluxes that are used, particularly on a flow solder machine. There was one particular production run of an ICOM rig, the ICOM, I think it was the 475, 275 series, the 2-meter and 440 version. I think I've got the model number right, but I'm not sure. But there was a run of ICOM rigs where for some reason a mistake was made and they didn't wash off the flux that was used from the flow solder machine. And boy, did that create a whole lot of intermittent contacts downrange and a lot of flaky working rigs. I owned one of those rigs for a while, and boy, it was a pain. Okay, I hope we have covered all of the people who signed in who said they did have a question, and the ones that we haven't put to sleep with all of the discussion of oil burners. Sorry about that, but it is a hot subject, pun intended. And boy, it creates a lot of interest among people. And there's quite a bit of grief going on there that can be corrected, in my opinion. So is there anyone else who signed in and who we skipped over by mistake? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW and the Tech Man.
Yeah, one more thing, Dick. K2KEY.
Mel recognized. Let's see if we've skipped anybody first. Is there anybody we skipped? Okay, looks like we didn't. You got it, Mel.
I'm just going to tell you about one other thing that I bet you never heard of for fixing up picture tubes. It was called a gun hammer. It was a neck hammer. It was a thing they came up with, a rubber-type mallet that you could hit the neck of the tube without busting it. And supposedly, if you hit the neck sometimes, it cleared up the trouble in the picture tube, Dick, over.
That sounds like a slightly more modern-day version of a radio mallet. Used to have microphonic tubes that you would hit with something very similar. Was the radio mallet also the picture tube bumper that you're talking about? Go ahead.
It was specifically made for a picture tube. It banged the picture tube, but it tapped it. Tap, 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 tap. And all of a sudden, you saw the picture get nice and cleaned up. All of a sudden, there it was, working again. And listen, they had such things, Dick, because those days, it was like a free-for-all. You know, there was no real regulations in a lot of things. And anything you came up with, ideas, you could sell it, Dick. I saw so many things on the market, the most ridiculous things, you know that. And they got away with selling them, over.
Well, anything you do to get more light out of your picture tube was sort of worth it, because on most of the television sets of our day, The picture tube was by far the most expensive component in that whole darn cabinet. And I guess the raw price of the picture tube, before the price of installation and alignment, the raw price of the picture tube was what? Half a week's salary, something like that, Seth Mel? Go ahead.
Well, you got to look at TV sets in those days. You know, if you go back into the 40s, I'll remember, never forget my mother. We didn't have a TV set until 1948, I remember, because, actually, I don't think I could afford it. But 1948, she saved up. She went to work. She had a little job for a couple hours a day in a local store she helped out. And she put the money secretly away and surprised us with a RCA, that time, the first 16-inch television set they came out, which I still have because it's a collector's item. And it had a metal picture tube, a 16-inch round tube with a metal bell. And that set was, I got the original bill, original book, and everything was $485 for that TV set, 1948. My father was bringing home salary at that time about $47, I believe, a week, if I remember correctly. And if I remember the discussion, how could you go out and buy a thing like this? So it took, it would look, at, for the average person, that would have been that 16-inch black and white set would have been good, maybe close to 3 months' income, over.
Wow. Yeah, the very first set that we bought, around 1947, my grandfather bought a RCA 630 10-inch set, and we bought a 10-inch Philco. I seem to remember it was $525 in 1947. And yes, you're right. Salaries in those days were numbers like $40 a week. So we're talking about 10, 11, 12 weeks salaries. Amazing, by modern standards. I guess the modern day equivalent of that would be, wow. I'm not sure. What does a person get these days? Let's see now. I'm going to make a guess. A median income is somewhere around 70 grand a year, which is what, around a little over $1,200 or so per week, if I got that right. So, wow. We're talking about $10,000, $15,000 equivalent today for what we paid for television sets in those days. Can you imagine trying to justify $10,000 or $15,000 for the price of a television set today, Mel? Not even the most, well, there was a price like that, oh, 7 or 8 years ago, for a really large plasma screen, high-definition television. They were numbers in the 18 grand category. But only very special organizations could afford those kind of numbers. Probably right time for you to pass comments on this and open up the mailbag, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, you know, this is K2KEY, the final comments on it. They had in one of these magazines, somebody sent me a copy of, a whole thing about Cortlandt Street, New York, and also about Harrison Radio. And in the article, in fact, it tells the story of the KWS-1, the particular KWS-1 that was sold, and what happened to it after it was sold. You know, it's life where it went from one person to another person and all. And the bottom of the, well, they have to go through a very humorous story of how it was stored and how it was used for a while. But the bottom line of the story was it was called the Gold Twist Column KWS 17584 series that was produced back in the 50s. And the bottom line was that if that radio was produced today, would be, if I could say, what prices are today, but the equivalent price for those days to today, that rig would be $40,000. When we look at radio hammering rigs today, we see, oh boy, a couple thousand dollars for a deluxe transceiver and all. It's cheap. This radio, Collins radio, would have been today $40,000, Dick, over.
Oh. sort of see why not very many people owned them in those days. Another thing that was kind of amazing to me in the late 60s is the number of Collins ham radio rigs that ended up doing communication service in Vietnam, because the mil-spec rigs that were being rapidly built for that particular war were not as plentiful as they should have been, not as reliable as they should have been. So I bet you've heard some of the stories that I've heard of the number of Collins ham radio rigs that were doing communication work in the Vietnam War. K2KEY, ready for the mailbag, K2LAW.
Dick, just a comment. Did you know that, I was surprised to hear this recently, they brought KWM2 back to Gulf War?
Wow, where did you read that one or hear about that one, Rich?
Joel, K2QBZ, bought one in surplus after the Gulf War.
Yeah, there were a few hams over there that were at least telling status of what was taking place, if not actually involved in the war effort. I guess in theory, at least by American standards, the ham radio license is not allowed to be used for a commercial service, but I think you're allowed to use ham radio frequencies legally when life and limb is at risk. And I guess I can see quite a few scenarios in which, in wartime, life and limb is at risk, and if radio could be used to save life and limb, I think it becomes legal. Wonder if either Rich or Ramil have got an opinion on that one.
Roger, this is K2KEY, of course. Under certain circumstances, anything that goes, you know, it has to be involving, you know, somebody's life. Any way that you can put out a signal, you don't have to be licensed to, you know, put out a signal of some sort, whatever kind of signal, if they'll get help, I guess it'll fly. You're not gonna get into trouble with Uncle Sam. But one final comment. You talked about, I was privy to the Vietnam. They took together, it was a whole pile of Collins equipment. I'll never forget, they were delivering it. And they put it into one of these rope nets, you know, these big nets that they used to lift with a helicopter. They put all kinds of equipment and things into it. And they piled in a whole pile of transmitters, receivers and things, mostly Collins, into this net, this helicopter that picked it up and then delivered it back to the warehouse where I was briefly in that area. And you can imagine when he lowered, came down with that helicopter, lowered that net onto the landing pad, what happened, how they just piled all that stuff together. I'm telling you, I think I almost cried, Dick, over.
Yeah, Glenn recognized. My first question now, Mel, was that equipment being moved into the war or taken out of the war? And when that net was dropped on the ground by the helicopter, was there bouncing going on, or were they managed to make it land very softly? Over to you first, Mel.
Just bounced it down, right? That stuff just bounced. It was all piled together like junk anyhow. And it wasn't set down. This was stuff that was supposedly being returned for repairs. They used a tremendous amount of that stuff, especially the dirty L1 linear amplifiers. They were really in use. In fact, they went ahead and mentioned the Gulf War and all. They resurrected a lot of those amplifiers, the dirty L1s, and were used again in the Gulf War. There was a lot of that column stuff that was hanging around a lot of years, Dick, over.
Very interesting. You got it, Glenn.
I just wanted to mention again what Rich had mentioned about the KWM-2 being used in the Gulf War for Desert Storm and Desert Shield. There's an interesting article on QRZ.com from the QRZ staff. The number was K9STH. And he has a whole article about how RF Harris was having problems with their HF equipment, and basically the KWM-2 is really what built it out. It's quite interesting article if you have a chance to read it.
So I think you're saying that's currently being shown on QRZ.com?
I think if you do a Google search and just type in, I think, like KWM-2 K9STH from QRZ, you should come right up to that article.
Sounds like fun. Back to you, Bill.
Okay, this is K2KUI. Yeah, I saw a lot of things that were done with Collins equipment. Some of it was pretty sad. And it was just what you do. Just what the situation. But the KWM-2, Harris resurrected it. And they basically brought in for the amplifier, their 30L1, which used four 572Bs, or original ones, used four 811 in parallel. And very compact, wonderful little amplifier. I have that KWM2, the 30L1, excuse me. It was the 30L1 used in conjunction, direct plug one to the other, plug the M2 and the 30L1 together, and that was a beautiful setup. That was a really gives you either a 100 watt or a 1 kilowatt transceiver setup stick. So it was the setup that was the envy of many hams back in the day. Over
at those kind of prices, I can see why they were so valuable. And looks like that was really built sort of a Cadillac of its day, wasn't it, Mel?
Yeah, Roger. Yeah, it was the Dream Station. They used to call it the Dream Station. All the Collins equipment. All right. Anyhow, I think maybe we take a couple of mail stick over.
Yeah, that's what I recommend we do, so you don't get any more derogatory mail.
That's not the derogatory, you know. I guess it's of interest to people actually sticking with amateur radio to a great extent. I know, even though I'm sure it's very important to discuss other things such as heating, which we'll be using a lot of pretty soon. Let me get something interesting here. Let me look through it and get a chance to see if I can pull out a couple of ones that we can do something with. Okay, here's one. This is interesting, you know. You mentioned many times you use a Hustler antenna on your mobile. Yes, and quite a popular antenna. I got a number of questions about them. One here, this fella asked, if I replace the bottom section, which is a basically a pipe, you know, the Hustler is a top-loaded mobile antenna. The coil sits on top. And it uses the pipe that it's a solid pipe. It's brass. And it says it's brass pipe with a chrome plating. If I replace this with a copper pipe, would it be an improvement in the antenna? How many times I've been asked that, to do what they use instead of brass, as this case, or aluminum with copper pipe, is that an improvement in your antenna, stick? Over.
Okay, you've owned the Hustler. Before I give an approximation of what I think is going on, give me a rough guess. What is the diameter of the pipe we're talking about, Mel? Go ahead.
It's about a half-inch pipe. I can say chrome-plated. It has a fold, has a hinge in the middle that you pull down the sleeve and you can, you know, normally bend it over to change the coil. Unscrew the coil and screw on a different coil for a different band. In other words, normally they come up with these multi-coil contraptions to put up on top there. But basically, that was the way that you had to change the band, that you have to change the coil, Dick. The pipe was about, the pipe itself is, I think if you don't put any coil on top of it, it basically is a 10-meter antenna, I believe so, yeah. Yeah, because a lot of them was were used by CDers without the top-loading coil, Dick, over.
Now, you and I have built dipoles on 10, 15, 20, 40, and 80 meters. We've often used 14-gauge, 16-gauge, 12-gauge household wire. We're talking about copper wire that's probably in the vicinity of an eighth inch in diameter. And if we did an exhaustive study, I think we would discover that those dipoles are running 99% efficiency, and the 1% of inefficiency of the dipole itself is due to the ohmic resistance of that copper. Now, ohmic resistance is a function of what is the resistivity of the material. Are you using silver, copper, brass, gold, bronze, nichrome, stainless steel, almost any of those materials, no matter how high the resistivity is, how poor a conductor it is, if the conductor is large enough in diameter, the resistance starts becoming a very low number. That's basic physics. The half-inch diameter pipe is the equivalent of what? A quadruple zero piece of conductor, if it was made out of copper, is a very large diameter compared to the 14-gauge household wire we often use. Let me drop. So that's the first step telling me that once you've got a conductor that large in diameter, to make it lossy is hard. A second factor is that if an antenna has loss, there is only one mechanism of loss: heat. The only way an antenna can take the RF energy and waste it is, number one, it can send it back to the transmitter due to standing wave ratio. But if you do a good job of impedance matching, that problem is gone. Number two, it can take the RF energy you put into it and radiate it into space. That's what you desire. And number three, the only other thing the antenna can do is take the RF energy you've given it and turn it into heat because of I squared R insertion loss mechanism. In other words, there's a certain current flowing through a certain resistance, and that creates heating. When in doubt, heating is an extremely sensitive test. You pour 100 watts into an antenna for 10 solid minutes, heat out. Turn up the transmitter, run over the real fast, and touch the antenna. If the antenna was dissipating 1 watt out of 100, 1% loss, 1 watt would create an amount of heat that your hand would easily feel. You'd know about it. So, if your antenna can fail the hot hand test, if you know what I mean, 100 watts of power, 1 solid minute, and you go over there and touch it, and if it's cold to the touch, it has no loss mechanism. After that, you're worrying about something that's probably not worth worrying about. So, first of all, the diameters and resistivities, as long as you're not using nichrome or stainless steel, which is pretty yucky stuff conductor-wise, it's hard to get loss. But if you have doubt, find out if it's getting hot. If it runs cold, there's nothing it can do except radiate it into space. You got it, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, so the bottom line is that we could say that brass with the chrome plating that is supplied by Hustler, there would be no advantage to changing that over to a piece of equivalent copper pipe, correct? Over.
That's my strongly felt assessment, Mill, but I haven't done the experiment. But the way to do the experiment, rather than waste the time building it out of copper, would be to run the experiment. Does it get hot to the touch? If it runs ice cold, if every component on the antenna runs ice cold, then it's got no mechanism of inefficiency. That's the only way it can do it. And even if something does get hot, the next question is, how hot? If your ceramic insulator got mildly warm to the touch, maybe that represents 2 watts of loss. And 2 watts of loss out of 100 watts you're putting into it is still 98% efficiency. The decibels loss of 2% is such a small number, nobody except a guy making careful laboratory measurements are going to be able to detect the difference. That's my feeling on this one. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, let's carry that one further. This is K2KEY. Have you ever seen an application of antenna that instead you prefer to make the antenna instead it's out of a Yagi type of, let's stick with a Yagi type of configuration, that you made the Yagi out of copper pipe, you would think that would be superior to making it out of aluminum pipe, Dick, over?
I think almost all the time the answer is no. I'm a member of the WA1MBA microwave reflector. There was a guy from Scandinavia about 3 years ago who did an exhaustive study on this exact subject. He worried about the approximately 3/16 diameter aluminum rods that were being used for Yagi antennas on 432 for moonbound. He wanted the last little bit of performance, and he wanted to quantify the amount of loss he's getting out of those 3/16 diameter aluminum rods. Let me think now. 3/16 is, I guess, around 150 thou. That's around 4 millimeters. So he's running 4 millimeter European grade aluminum 6061 G6 rods. And in order to measure the loss, he made himself a very accurate copper cavity, which I'm guessing was something in the vicinity of 3 feet long and 1 foot square. He made pictures of this and transmitted it on the internet. And we all looked at this and said, wow, that's a test. So he made this copper cavity as lossless as he possibly could. High conductivity copper sheet, carefully soldered, shielded, the corners of this cavity. And then what he did was to take aluminum and copper rods of the right length, suspend them in a piece of foam block inside of this cavity, and measure their bandwidth as a resonator. Because he's putting the rod of the director or reflector or driven element of the Yagi inside of this cavity, it could not radiate into space. It's inside of a shield, high conductivity chamber. The only real loss was the rod itself. And by measuring the bandwidth of that rod resonance, he knew its Q, and with the calculation, he could therefore calculate how much resistance it had. Let me drop. And therefore, what amount of efficiency the moon bounce antenna would have constructed out of those materials. I don't remember the exact bottom line, but I do remember that the aluminum rods we used were more than sufficient for reasonable length Yagis, like a 16-element Yagi. Now, I think he was concluding that if you get into a really exotic structure, like a 100-element Yagi on 432 built out of those aluminum rods, where now the total number of elements and the circulating currents and whatever start building up pretty fast, I think he calculated he'd have a significant amount of loss. So I think the bottom line was the loss at 432 for reasonable length Yagis with the kind of materials people were using was not worth worrying about. It wasn't zero, but it wasn't a showstopper. It wasn't worth worrying about. So, now I have experimented with Yagis with very wide elements on 900 megacycles. But there my motivation was bandwidth of the overall Yagi structure, not efficiency. So I had an entirely different motivation when I did it. With wider diameter elements, you do get some extra bandwidth. And at certain kinds of tuning procedures, that's worth fighting for. But again, with your Yagi, pour a kilowatt into it for 10 minutes, 1 minute. It's got a thermal time constant of seconds. Pour a kilowatt into your Yagi, stand back with a good piece of transmission line 10 feet, and do it for one solid minute. Turn off the transmitter, run over there, and find out if anything's hot. There is no mechanism of resistive loss of those elements that you could have that wouldn't show up as heat. And if you want to be real exotic about it, use a thermal imaging camera, an infrared camera. And one of my clients that I work with bought an infrared camera to do just that, to measure what gets hot. And we're forced to do that test because we're being forced to squeeze antennas into very small packages where there's a whole lot of plastic and integrated circuits and other stuff stuffed in around the antenna. But now you've got what looks like a bunch of mechanisms that could be creating I-squared-R loss. and by looking at it with, at everything when it's operating with a thermal imaging camera, you immediately find out if somebody's eating your lunch and who's doing it, and what you got to do to stop it from happening. It's a quantitative, beautiful test. K2KEY.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I saw the thermal camera, and I was going to say earlier where I saw the application when they came in the house here, and they did a an insulation check to show us where the heat loss was. They used that that camera. Quite interesting to see on the monitor what they were picking up. You could actually see, you know, where the insulation had to be put. Very good. Yeah. So in other words, the bottom line is that brass plate is with the chrome on top of that brass plate on where a mobile antenna, you really want to do your best, of course, to get the most out of it. But you, that, the bottom line is that brass with the chrome plating will most likely work as well, or in other words, no, there would be no improvements by putting a copper pipe, to your knowledge, in place of it. Over.
That's my strongly felt opinion. Not traceable to the Bureau, but that's what I really believe. But when in doubt, go make that hot hand test, and you'll confirm it for yourself, Mel. Go ahead.
You need the thermal camera. very good. Okay, in fact, here's another question, basically almost on the same thing with the mobile antennas. I have to read it over here, and they're looking for almost something similar, but it's interesting. You guys have discussed coils many times, and I'm wondering, for a mobile antenna, they make two different coils. Most of the antennas are orbit for a low power and then some for high power. The high power ones have a larger coil with bigger, heavier wire. Does this mean that the Q of the coil is higher? Well, that's true. The bigger the wire, the lower the DC resistance. Actually, I guess you could say the higher the Q. So does it pay then, if you say you're running 100 watts, to buy the better mobile, the larger coil mobile antenna, Dick, over?
The answer is yes, but is it a big enough difference to be justified? When it comes to the Q of a coil, there's two different kinds of Q. There is the unloaded Q, in other words, the coil all by itself. And you would resonate the coil by putting the appropriate size capacitor across it, and then measure the bandwidth of that resonance. That's one of the methods by which you can measure its unloaded Q. But in almost all circuits where we use a coil, there's other stuff connected to it that acts as a resistive load. Now, when I say resistive load, you've got to be careful now. If it's a coil that's part of a inductor that's part of an antenna, the resistance I'm talking about might not be a ohmic resistance of the antenna. Quite possibly it's the ohmic resistance equivalent of what's called radiation resistance. The process by which the radio's energy leaves that antenna makes it act like there's a real resistor there. It happens to be a lossless resistor. The antenna itself is running cold if it's a well-made antenna. But you're radiating energy into space, and you could plug in a resistor in a certain position in a circuit and get the same kind of performance. So there is a so-called radiation resistance. So if your coil has a high enough unloaded Q, and it's the coil itself we're talking about, so therefore only unloaded Q matters, and if you make it out of a larger diameter of wire, you're going to pick up more performance. If you're picking up 10% more performance, yeah, I would spend the money. If you're picking up 1% more performance, I don't think anybody's going to know about it. You're about to ask the question, how do you know which case you're in? Once again, it's a hot hand test as I see it. If you think your coil is wasting some of your RF energy, pour 100 watts into that antenna for 1 minute, turn off the transmitter, go over there, and put your hand on that coil. If it's cold to the touch, stop worrying. If it's hot to the touch, now it's time to start figuring out how hot. Is the hot equivalent to 1 watt? Ignore it. If it's hot equivalent to 10 watts out of 100, now it's starting to approach
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
If it's 10 watts out of 100, 10 watts of heating, or 20 watts of heating, it's starting to approach my threshold of alarm, where I want to start doing something about it. And making the coil out of a larger diameter wire, buying the bigger coil, might be worth it. There's a number of situations in life where buying the bigger, better, more expensive thing gives you a warm feeling that, hey, I'm buying quality. Well, you might be gilding the lily. You might be gold-plating a lily and not really changing its function, if you know what I mean. We have the ability to make the measurements to find out quantitatively if it's worth the expense. You don't have to just guess at it. K2KEY, K2LIW.
K2LIW.
2EO.
Hey, everybody, this is K2KEY. All right, let us explore this one a little further. If we said that the Q, we're taking this loading coil for the mobile antenna, and we said, that, well, Q is the, let's say for 40 meters, a 40-meter loaded coil for the mobile antenna, the 40-meter version of it that screws on up there. And I said that, well, let's say that the Q would be equal to the inductive reactance, say 50 ohms, divided by the resistance, the DC resistance. So let's say now that this coil, we measure it, but just measuring the coil in this respect, and say, well, one with the coil has the lower power coil has a DC resistance of, say, 1 ohm. So that would equal a Q of 50. However, if we measure the DC resistance of the larger coil, and it has a resistance of, say, a half an ohm, then the Q would be, well, be 50 divided by 0.5 would give a Q of 100. I mean, would that sound like, I don't know, in the ballpark way of thinking, Dick, over?
Yeah, there's a yes and a no to that, Mel. First of all, you said the DC resistance of the coil, and I know what you meant. And if I add DC with a 4-terminal ohmmeter, I made what's called a Kelvin ohmmeter test. It's a very accurate test by which you can measure milliohms of accuracy. If I did that at DC, I would come up with a number. But when I'm operating that coil at, say, 40 meters, 7 megacycles, where there is skin effect, only the outer 1,000th of an inch of copper is doing any of the work. The RF energy doesn't sink below that. The DC resistance sees the whole depth of the copper coil wire in cross-section. But the RF current only sees the upper 1,000th of an inch or 10,000th of an inch, depending on what frequency and what conductivity. Very little depth does the RF go because of skin effect. That's the resistance that counts. But even through your example, a Q of 50 and a Q of 100, is it worth fighting for? There's a yes and a no. If that coil is being used for a critical resonator, where I wanted the most narrow bandwidth possible, and a very high Q circuit, where I'm lightly loading the coil, the Q of 100 versus Q of a 50, in a nanosecond, it's worth going for. In a heartbeat, go for it. However, if that coil is part of the matching network of an antenna, where the antenna loads the coil down, so even though its unloaded Q was 50, but I'm loading it down to a Q of 10, and the one that had a Q of 100 unloaded, I'm loading it down to a Q of 11 because of the way the circuit acts. Now we're comparing in the operating circuit an operating Q of 10 versus 11. Is it worth fighting for? Now it ain't so clear. So that exact same coil, In one application, I should buy the better one. In the other application, maybe I shouldn't. There's a little more to the story than first meets the eye. Of the guys that first signed in, the first man said it so fast I couldn't catch his call letters. Give me those call letters again, sir.
KC2LYU, do you have a copy name?
LYU, I sure do. Thought of reading Amon.
Oh. Name is Danielle. Let me tell you, I have a hospital antenna mobile. I have a coil from 10, 20, I have 140 meters. The coil is nothing. It looks like the outside. It's all messy. Inside, I don't know if it's still good. Somebody using them is still good, but it looks like it's all melting. The coil or 40 meters. Back to your deck.
Very fine, Daniel. You've got a tough case there. If you're melting the plastic for the heat of that coil, and if you're running at a kilowatt, and it's rated for a kilowatt, well, somebody did something wrong. If it's rated for 100 watts, and you're putting 500 watts into it, now you sort of understand why it's melting. But when you're melting the plastic, that's a pretty strong indication that you're at the threshold of alarm. A loss of that coil doesn't sound good. Now, maybe the total loss, if you really did a laboratory careful measurement, maybe it's 20 watts of loss, 20 watts of heat in that coil could melt the plastic. 20 watts out of the 100 watts you're running is about a dB of loss. So if the coil had no loss compared to the melting coil you got, the guy you're talking to maybe would be, he would hear you one decibel louder. And six decibels is an S unit, so it's one-sixth of an S unit, if that's the numbers. It's significant, but now it's not a showstopper, except for a very rare DX station you want to talk to. Would 1 dB more signal allow you to break through that pileup? Maybe, but that's kind of a rare circumstance. Let me ask you this, Daniel. That melting coil, that particular antenna, what was the rated power, and what power were you putting into it? KC2LYU, K2LIW, my name is Dick.
KC2LYU, I never run the coil antenna. I got it for donation from a club, and we tried, me and my friend of mine, and the antenna started working. I never used it, and I know it's coil to melt it. I want to show next time to Mel. Mel must be, you know, the guy who passed away. Most of them are using the 20, 40, and 80 megahertz. But the 40 megahertz is complete gone. But it's still good. It's melting the outside the plastic. Somebody tapped this for tape. Why don't I say any good? Back to your deck, I guess, I believe.
Now, that's an interesting antenna. I think you said you want to show it to Mel. Mel, is Daniel one of the members of your club where you and Nahi are about to have an eyeball? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah, Danny is a member of our club, and I'll take a look at it. I assume that it was, it's most likely misused because the standard Tesla coil, antenna coils, are only usually good for around, conservatively, they say, 150 watts or whatever, but, I'm sure that they pump a lot more power people into them. Go on. I was just going to make another comment about Q, but pick up the other station, Dick, first. And then, I was thinking something in a way you just reminded me of Antenna Q as a good example. But first, pick up the other station, Dick.
Very fine. I think it was Glenn, KC2QIQ. Was that you, Glenn?
It's me, Dick, and 2EO. What I wanted to say is, that person who wrote in the email was asking about the bigger coil, the higher power coil, and it's not the Q, if he's listening. It's the fact that when you run higher power, the antenna current is higher. So, of course, the coil is going to get hot because the smaller coil has a less cross-sectional area. That's the reason for the bigger coil. I guess in a way it relates to heat, but it has to do with the antenna current being much higher. It increases by a square root. So at the lower power level, he's not going to gain anything by using a kilowatt coil. Back to you, Dick.
There's a yes and a no to that, Rich. If the bigger coil in the operating circuit gave you 1 decibel less insertion loss of the antenna due to heating loss, then you're going to get 1 dB of increase whether you're running a kilowatt or whether you're running QRP 1 watt. You're going to get a dB is a dB, regardless of what power you're putting into it. However, you're onto something when you say that the bigger coil is primarily designed for the higher power. But why is it designed for the higher power? Let me show you. The loaded Q of a circuit has about 4 definitions. One of the definitions of Q is the current rise that you get at resonance or the voltage rise you get at resonance. So, if I'm putting, I wish I knew now the exact numbers, a kilowatt, I think it's something like I squared R. I should be able to figure this out. Power is I squared R is a kilowatt divided by 50, 200, square root of 200. I guess we're talking about 15 amperes. There's roughly 15 amperes, very rough approximation, 15 amperes of current flowing down the center conductor of your 50-ohm coax cable when you're pouring a kilowatt into that cable. 15 amperes of wireless current, if I did the math right, is flowing down that center conductor. And you would therefore think that, hey, the center conductor of the coax cable is feeding the base of this antenna. I'm pumping 15 amps at the bottom. It's going to be 15 amps distributed somewhere around that antenna. Not necessarily. If there's a resonating coil somewhere in that antenna, let's make the coil near the base. There's some kind of an impedance matching device. And if under loaded conditions, under real operating conditions, that coil is running at a loaded Q of 10, that means there is a 10-to-1 increase in current in the coil versus the circuit right alongside of it that's feeding it. 15 amperes times 10 is 150. That's starting to get significant. If you've got 150 RF amperes flowing through some portion of your circuit, it better have a lot of beef to it. So, loaded Q, current rise,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
Loaded Q, which gives you the number of multiplication of the current rise at resonance in the operating circuit, gives you a little bit of a feel for the mechanism by which it gets hot. A smart guy who knows the Q of his coil, and he can get that by a calculation, knowing that it's copper wire, 8-inch diameter, X number of turns, so many nanohenries or microhenries of inductance, calculated so much RF resistance, it's on a circuit resonating at this frequency. If you know the parameters of the coil and you get smart enough, you can calculate with at least 10% accuracy, 90% accuracy, 10% error, what is the loaded Q likely to be. If you're a little bit smarter yet, with a good grid dip meter, making some measurements on that coil, you can measure its Q in reality. But knowing the Q of the coil and something about the circuit it's buried in, again, if you're smart enough, you can calculate what amount of loss it'll have. Even if you don't want to do the calculation, you can make the measurement with the hot hand test that I've been talking about. So by hook or by crook, you can find out with pretty good accuracy, good enough, good ballpark figures, how much loss am I getting from that coil? Will it tolerate the kilowatt I want to put into it? Should I beef it up? Is the dollars I'm going to pay and the man hours I'm going to pay, is it worth? Am I going to get enough decibels of increase and enough increase in reliability of the antenna to go for it? These are some of the questions you're likely to ask yourself, and if you're enthusiastic enough, those answers are within your reach. I didn't say it's easy. Nothing in life that's worth doing is easy. But you can get at it if you want to bad enough. That's a strongly felt opinion. I'm going to turn it over to you now. Drag your feet a little bit in case anyone wants to add their comments. K2KEY, a little delay. K2RIW on the TechNet.